Recording this. So I'm Kurt Dewhurst, the director of the Center for Great Lakes Culture. It's great to have you here. Appreciate you coming out for today's colloquium. This is a series that we do with the center, working in partnership with the MSU Library, and we're very pleased. We've been doing this now for a couple of years, and we are doing a series of talks, and all of the talks connect in some way with the work of the center. But we always look forward to talks that feature the work of fellows of the center. And we're very pleased today to have one of those fellows doing a talk. But before I introduce her formally, I did want to say a couple of things to you. We have up here some flyers that I'll urge you to take on the way out, if you will. The postcard there is for a new exhibition that just opened at the MSU Museum and also at Nokomis Learning Center, looking at the Ho-Chunk people. The exhibit is called Honoring the Ho-Chunk Warrior at the MSU Museum, and there are additional photographs connected to this by Tom Jones. And this is a project that was developed by Dr. Susan Krause, who was last year's MSU CGLC faculty fellow, and this is one of the outcomes of that research, so I urge you to take a moment and stop over to both museums and see the really remarkable photographs and the experience of documenting a wonderful Veterans Memorial powwow held over Memorial Day weekend. In addition to that, there's some other flyers for upcoming colloquia events at the library, and I urge you to take those as well. We have another CGLC library colloquium coming up on the 7th of April with Adriana Green, who is also a CGLC, technically a visiting fellow for us this semester, and she's going to be talking about her research then. You can watch for a flyer on that as well. But it's my pleasure today to introduce this year's Center for Great Lakes Culture faculty fellow, Dr. Mindy Morgan, who is from the Department of Anthropology, an assistant professor there, and she's going to talk to us today about Ojibwa in and out of the classroom and the project that she's been working on this year. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for that, and thanks all for coming this afternoon, especially as spring break is approaching. I know that thoughts turn elsewhere, so I appreciate your coming out today as well. Today, before I actually begin, I wanted to go ahead and start with a thank you, which I definitely need to give both for the Center for Great Lakes Culture and particularly Kurt for giving me both the support and kind of venue for talking about some of the ideas that I'm going to talk about today. I also wanted to thank also the library, and especially thanks to Peter Burke, who through emails and so forth was able to coordinate everything, and especially even the last minute PowerPoint presentation. So I certainly appreciate that help from all of you today. But I also need to talk some of the themes that I'm going to be talking about today. These are some ideas that I'm starting to work with and some things that I'm starting to think about, but it hasn't been done in isolation by any means. And a lot of the things that I'm talking about today is really the accumulated knowledge of some very talented people who for many of them have been working decades within issues in terms of preserving indigenous languages, and particularly in teaching indigenous languages. And so I wanted to give a particular thanks to all of the people whose conversations I'm going to be talking about today. These are conversations that I've had with these people who I do. This is their knowledge that I appreciate them sharing with me and talking with me about it. In particular, Mrs. Helen Roy, who is the Ojibwe language instructor here at Michigan State University and here in the audience. So when we get to questions, I will defer to her most definitely. And also Mr. George Roy, James Mikelich, and Neil McKay, who are both language teachers at the University of Minnesota, and also Patricia Albers, Yvonne Kelly, Vicki Howard, and Dr. John Nichols, all at the University of Minnesota. And again, some of the ideas that I take responsibility for all the ideas that I say today, but in fact, this really is representative of a longer conversation that I've had with these very talented individuals. And my last thank you, to start with the thank yous, I know that seems a little bit odd, but I wanted to also thank all of both the past and the present students who are in the Ojibwe classes, both at Michigan State University and University of Minnesota. I have been a little bit of an interloper, particularly at the Michigan State classes, and I appreciate them being there in the classroom and kind of taking part. A lot of the past students, unfortunately, they're not. A lot of them aren't here today. But this is an incredible group of people who are just not. They're not just only concerned with learning the language, but they are interested in larger issues surrounding making sure that Ojibwe, in particular, is both maintained and preserved and revitalized. And so, this is the. I just wanted to also acknowledge them. So, with that, let me go ahead and get back to some of the ideas that I'm talking about. The title of my talk is indeed Ojibwe In and Out of the Classroom, Models for Indigenous Language Programs Within the University System. But it really is much more of my talk is about Ojibwe outside of the classroom rather than inside of the classroom. And that's actually one of the major points that I want to make, that any language program and languages in general, in order for them to be successful, there really has to be an emphasis on breaking down the walls of the traditional language classroom. This is particularly true, and for issues that I'm going to talk about in just a few minutes, for indigenous languages. That really, in order, when we're talking about success and successful language programs, that it really has to be a focus on how much is done outside of the classroom in addition to the solid work that is done inside of the classroom. It's as much about creating both arenas for language use and social networks and relationships between people that will really guarantee both the preservation and maintenance of the languages outside of the classroom setting. So with that, let me go ahead and get started. Oh, whoop. That was a little bit early, so I'll go back to this. As a means of introduction, why I focused on the issues of the university and the university system is there's a number of reasons why. But one of the reasons is that over the last 30 years, there has been a movement within the university systems as American Indian languages have been transformed from truly being an object of study to a subject of study. And this has been a very critical transformation. Formerly, these languages were seen as systems that needed to be isolated, studied, and analyzed largely by anthropologists and linguists within these universities. But now, indigenous languages are being taught within these same institutions and, in fact, are seen as central components of American Indian Studies programs across the country. So the talk today, I'm going to talk about some of these issues that have surrounded this, what I consider very critical transformation from object to subject. And while it has been a critical movement and have granted indigenous languages the recognition and status that they deserve, the changes have also illustrated specific requirements that attend to these languages and distinguish them from other heritage language programs that are found within the university system. So after a brief history, as a means of sort of introduction to the issues, I'm going to look at the rise of indigenous language programs in the United States, but I'm going to take a little bit of a step back and talk a little bit about the relationship between universities and indigenous languages. One of the contentions that I make both in this work and all of the work that I do is history does indeed matter, and it matters the relationship that universities have had with both indigenous language speaking communities and also the indigenous languages themselves, as that, I think, has an influence in the way that they're taught today. After a little bit of a historical context, I'm going to discuss some of the major issues, such as creating immersive environments and the importance of facilitating intergenerational learning that are really the keys to any successful indigenous language program. After I talk about some of these keys, I'm going to look at a series of language events that have been developed here at Michigan State University over the course of the last few years to address what I consider these specific needs of indigenous language programs. I'm also going to bring in comparative material from the University of Minnesota, where Ojibwe has been taught for the last 9 years, as a way of assessing Michigan State's program and to suggest a few new lines of development, especially in regard to institutional cooperation in support of indigenous language programs. Now, probably goes without saying, this is by no means an exhaustive investigation. This is really just the beginning. But I have some very specific reasons for focusing within indigenous language programs within the large research universities. I am not going to address, but I do at least want to acknowledge, the fact that there are a number of universities that do indeed teach indigenous languages. A lot of tribal colleges, in fact, I'll touch briefly on that. But the real kind of rise of teaching indigenous languages happened with the rise of the tribal college movement as well. I'm not going to talk about that today specifically, but there are a number of programs at both these universities other universities, Central Michigan as an example, and local community centers. But I really want to focus on the large research university, because the large research university does have this particular history, and as I'm going to argue, a particular role in playing with developing successful language programs. So let's go back a little bit into the history about why research universities. Now, the history is long, and the history is also not necessarily a positive one in terms of how indigenous languages have been treated within the university structure. If we want to go back, I am an anthropologist, I always go back to Franz Boas. Franz Boas, of course, is one of the people who's credited with the rise of American anthropology, but as many people know, and I won't go into it much, the cornerstone, of course, was the documentation of indigenous communities throughout the United States and Canada. And central to all of Boas's efforts was the documentation and description of indigenous languages. Boas emphasized this in his own work. He also emphasized it for all of his students. And in fact, when we look at the amount of material that's out there in terms of indigenous language material, a lot of it has its genesis within the university system, particularly Boas and Boas's students. Boas in particular, he worked with speakers, and this is kind of a critical point, is that Boas himself, of course, first started teaching at Clark University, but then moved to Columbia, and Columbia is where most of his work was accomplished. Franz Boas made a number of trips out to communities where he worked with speakers. George Hunt is the primary speaker, of course, that he worked with out in the Northwest Coast. But it's also important to know that Boas was trying to find speakers wherever he could. And in fact, a lot of his collaborations were with native speakers who were themselves either attending Columbia or attending other universities in the area. One of the most well-known relationships, of course, is Franz Boas with Ella Deloria, who herself was a Dakota speaker. And she worked with Franz Boas in actually creating a grammar and dictionary too as well for Dakota and Lakota. But so this is one of the ideas that was in terms of the universities and indigenous languages. The study of languages was a cornerstone since a lot of Boas' students were the ones who then farmed out and established a lot of the anthropology departments across the country. It really became American Indian Languages was a cornerstone of almost all of the departments that started within the United States. University of California at Berkeley is one of the primary ones, as well as University of Chicago and Yale University. People such as Edward Sapir, and goes on from there, were working with indigenous languages and then also within the university structure. But what's critical to mention, these people were out there and doing this work, but their focus was on this issue of documenting languages before they felt that the languages would be lost entirely. They were seen as a scientific object. There was not attention given to the fact that these were actually still being used within the communities. They were seen as something that were on their way out and therefore needed to be documented and preserved. So there was not necessarily an effort at all in terms of language, developing language pedagogy, developing any sort of ways of maintaining languages. The emphasis was purely, as they were calling, a quote-unquote scientific sort of documentation project. Some of the others, there's lots, and I could talk for a long time, but we want to talk about Ojibwe today, so I won't dwell on it. But I also wanted to mention a few other important sorts of moments within the early history of universities and indigenous languages as well. The Survey of California and Other Indian Languages was actually a program that was started by Mary Hawes in the mid-1950s at the University of California at Berkeley. She funded a number of linguists to do descriptive work. Many of these people who worked under Mary Hawes at Berkeley are now actually linguists at other major large research institutions today. So people are still very much who worked in this vein are still within the research universities today. Then also, the Linguistic Institute at Indiana University was another fairly well-known one that was established by Carl Vogelin and his wife, Flo Vogelin, also in the mid-1950s into the 1960s. And the Linguistic Institute, which was held in Bloomington, was a place where both linguists, people who were descriptive linguists, would come together and talk about issues of indigenous languages, but then also native speakers were also brought in to Bloomington to participate in these seminars as well. But the critical thing, once again, within these situations is that the language were still seen as objects. They were seen as something that could be analyzed. A lot of the questions that people were asking, particularly at the Linguistic Institute, were questions of origin, relationships, categorization. How do we catalog? How do we categorize languages? And so on and so forth. Again, people were not interested, nor were they really cognizant of the idea. And it's interesting because, of course, you know, all of these universities, Indiana, Berkeley, Columbia, they have large departments of Germanic studies. And in fact, a lot of the early Boasians came over from Germanics. Sapir is one of them. Kroeber, I think, was another, who both actually started their work in Germanic studies. But so they're teaching languages at these universities, but that same sort of idea was not extended to indigenous languages. They were seen as being something a little bit different. They were something that could be analyzed, but not necessarily something that should be taught. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up is that there is an incredible amount of material that is related to indigenous languages that is still held within research universities. Berkeley is probably, because of this survey, Berkeley is probably one of the greatest repositories for that. And Leanne Hinton, who is currently a linguistic anthropologist at the University of California in Berkeley, and if anybody is aware of a lot of the work on indigenous language preservation and maintenance programs, she's a name that's fairly well known. She developed the Master Apprentice Program that's used very widely today. But Leanne Hinton, for example, has made a call to suggest that Native communities need to both know about the fact that all of this material exists within the universities, that they should both acquaint themselves with it and see how they can integrate it into some of the efforts right now in terms of indigenous language preservation projects as well. But to move on to, so that's in some ways a general or a fairly quick history. But it did change. Where did the transformation happen? When did it happen? When was this movement from the idea of object into subject happen? Well, as everything, it's a fairly complicated answer. But it really began over 30 years ago, this transformation, that it recognized that, of course, that speakers were still in the community, that people were still using the language, but at the same time that the languages were being used and used less, and that there was a concern that the languages were no longer going to be spoken within the communities as well. And so it was about 30 years ago that that this happened. Now, I've just kind of isolated a few. These are kind of federal acts and so forth they weren't necessarily the impetus. In fact, what I would argue is that the impetus came from Native communities themselves who are organizing and taking control over local education and kind of called for a lot of changes that were happening then on the federal level. But it came out of this movement that, again, was highly localized, where really the idea of language as a subject of study, as something that people should actually spend time to both learn and understand, came about. The first of these was the Title VII, which was passed in 1968. It actually it was attached to the 1965 Elementary and Secondary Schooling Act, but it became known as the Bilingual Education Act in 1968. And though it wasn't specifically designed for Native communities, this legislation effectively what it did is it appropriated funds for the development of new bilingual programs. It also had a service training for teachers and the maintenance of already established programs. In its initial presentation to the Senate, the act actually only addressed the problems of the increasing numbers of Spanish-speaking children in schools. So in terms of the bilingual, it was really limited to Spanish-speaking children. But when the proposed act reached the House, the bilingual support was actually broadened to include all linguistic minorities within the United States. And the final text of the act was modified to children of limited English-speaking ability, which was defined as children who come from environments where the dominant language is other than English. This is what was critical in the act itself, and it included then Native American languages. And actually, the NCAI, the National Congress of American Indians, was very active in the testimonies for these acts, talking about the fact that here in the 1960s, kids were still coming from a home where Native languages were spoken, and that not only needed to be recognized, but it also needed to be appreciated. However, it is important to know, in particular for the 1968 Act, that the original impetus behind it was the integration of non-English speakers into the educational system. The Act viewed bilingual education as a way of overcoming language deficits, and it wasn't necessarily intended to maintain or to support bilingual communities. But the critical thing was is that it did make funds available, especially for the development of materials, bilingual and bicultural materials. And this is what a lot of Native communities then were able to successfully argue for and successfully get the funds for. The initial attempts for American Indian communities to get access to these funds were minimal. 76 projects under the first there were 76 projects that were funded under the first year of Title VII, but only five were actually designated for American Indian communities. But within the next 10 years, the number of projects grew substantially until 10% of actually all of the Title VII programs were for Native languages. And as I kind of intimated before, the Bilingual Education Act was in many ways an imperfect fit for the needs of many tribal groups because of its focus on English acquisition. But despite its limitations, many communities were able to use the available funding to create programs that encourage Native language instruction, despite the ultimate aims of the legislation, which again was to encourage people to speak English. Now, it was also coupled then with the passage of the 1972, and I won't go into this much, other legislation, but the 1972 Indian Education Act. And why it was important that these two acts kind of came at the same time was that it gave more power to tribes in determining the educational programs. And it also gave, it supported both the development of adult and higher education for Native communities. And a lot of the tribal college movement also has its beginnings in this as well. The Indian Education Act is also known as Title IV. And for people who have been in language teaching and so forth, you hear a lot about Title VII and Title IV funds. But it provided funding for both bicultural and bilingual education as a larger effort to encourage student retention and to encourage participation. The Act also importantly addressed issues of teacher training, especially for those who worked within Native communities, and it provided money for continuing education. Now, again, not to get too much into the specifics of it, it's not as necessary, but this came out of community efforts. This came out of the efforts of a lot of both local educators and Native educators in really assessing what were then seen as the problems that was actually coming out of the Kennedy Report in the mid-1960s. What were some of the problems that were happening within local schools that were specifically for Native students? And one of the arguments that these communities made so effectively, which is true, which is the fact that you had to understand who you are. And in order to understand who you are, you needed to know your language. That for kids to be successful in the school programs that had always been set up really for them not to succeed, that the best way of getting them to succeed was to both initiate and start language training, because that was the way that kids could kind of both figure out who they are and kind of how they fit within the public school system. At this time, again, this was much more of a community effort. It was aided. A lot of linguists worked also on the Bilingual Education Act, and some linguists who were affiliated with the universities. But the location of these programs always focused within the communities. And this is really the genesis of a lot of the language programs that we see today. Now, the other just kind of key points of legislation is, of course, the Native American Languages Act. And if anyone's following email and so on and so forth, you know that there's a lot of discussion right now about the Native American Languages Act, too. It just got expanded and broadened, and there's now some contention about how it conflicts with No Child Left Behind. It's an interesting discussion if anyone's interested in that. But essentially, this was legislation that was passed in the early 1990s that reinforced what had already been kind of stated throughout the 70s and the 80s, about the importance of language preservation. And what it also did was provided necessary funding for the development of community-centered language programs. In an organized campaign, the Native American Language Issues Institute was successful in passing the Native American Languages Act as Title I of the Reauthorization Act for Tribally Controlled Colleges. And basically, and I want to just tell you what the basic stipulations of this act are, because it has importance in terms of universities. The act states the United States is responsible for working with Native communities to ensure that Native languages survive by allowing exceptions in teacher certification for Native language teachers so that they are not held to the same credentialing standards that other teachers are, but in fact have, that's not to say that they're not credentialed, but that it is a locally governed credential system as opposed to a state board of education and so on and so forth. It also recognize that language is both as a means of instruction and a legitimate choice for foreign language requirements. And that was a stipulation that had a lot of impact within the universities. It basically stated something that should have almost been common sense, that taking an indigenous language, learning an indigenous language, was of the same and equal value of taking French or Spanish or so on and so forth. And any degree program that actually required a foreign language requirement should be able to accept an indigenous language in its stead. And it also allowed, in kind of the third stipulation, that that tribes could actually adopt native languages as official languages. And so, for example, the Crow Nation accepted it. And as always, sometimes with federal government, although the act acknowledged the importance of native languages in maintaining tribal cultures and identity, and it also admitted, which was a key point, the role of the federal government in suppressing native languages for the majority of the 20th century, it didn't provide any funding. So it was all talk and no teeth. The fault was remedied in part by the passage of Public Law 102-524, anybody wants to write it down, which allowed the government to award grants to the study of and development of Native American language programs. It was originally introduced as the Native American Languages Act of 91 and was signed into law in 92. The grants, what basically, and it did give some money, though not a whole lot, but it did give money to be administered through the Administration for Native Americans, ANA, so the ANA grants were established, and they could be used in both the development of community language programs, teacher training, the production of teaching materials, and the compilation of both of oral testimonies, oral stories, oral histories, and equipment purchasing. And it did give a minimal amount of financial support to fund both language study and maintenance. So that's just, again, a fairly brief overview of what was happening. But this is what then that really made the difference within the large research universities, which really moved indigenous languages out of the idea of being an object of study to a subject of study. It was building on both the enthusiasm and the camaraderie that was generated by the passage of the acts. New arenas kind of emerged for discussing language affairs. Whereas most Native communities prior to this, throughout the 70s, throughout the 80s, had been working in relative isolation in the early bilingual programs, in the emerging ideological environment of the 1990s, groups began to seek inspiration and ideas from other communities faced with similar problems. The universities at this point became centers where speakers, language teachers, and linguists could come together and organize. Regional efforts such as the American Indian Languages Development Institute, ALDI, which is the University of Arizona, and then NALI, which I spoke about, which was in the Southwest, in Oklahoma. So NALI, which is the Native American Languages Issues Institute, was developed at the University of Oklahoma. Both of these institutions really gained both attention and prominence. In addition, these groups assumed a very political role in both protecting endangered languages and playing a prominent role in securing legislation and funding. Also, what these also did was really give a place for teacher training for those that were involved in language projects at tribal colleges within public schools. And I just want to, I won't go through all of these, but why, there are actually more. There are more universities, but I put these up as kind of critical ones because they all offer something that was quite important. So the University of Arizona, ALDI is still associated with it. They have annual conferences and their summer workshops that are generally about a month long. And what they do is they bring in language educators, mostly from the Southwest. It is very much a regional focus, but people do come from all over the country. But a large part is from the Southwest. But what it does is bring in both speakers, elders, teachers, language educators, and linguists, and they all workshop together. So you'll have a class in like linguistic, structure and description and all that sort of thing, but then you'll also talk about language planning, language pedagogy, talk about funding. So it's become a very large center where people can come together. And it focuses mostly on bringing in people who are in local communities and working with local community language programs. The University of Arizona also has an American Indian Studies program, and a lot of their students become involved with indigenous language issues as well because of the prominence of ALDI. University of Kansas has a similar sort of program. They have the Center for Indigenous Nations, which was established by Donald Fixico, who was on campus here a few months ago. But at the University of Kansas, through the center, you can actually do a specific track in learning about indigenous languages. And again, it combines classes in linguistics, teacher education, so on and so forth, and students work on a project to really kind of develop curriculum for it as well. They don't teach necessarily indigenous languages at Kansas, but this is actually, it grew out of a partnership with Haskell University, which of course is right there in Lawrence as well. I'll mention, I kind of have them a little bit out of order, Indiana University, kind of the legacy of Voegelin. There's been a maintenance in terms of work on terms of indigenous language maintenance and so on and so forth. The workshops that happened in the 1950s, they actually still do occur, but in a very different sort of way. Various educators are still brought into Indiana to work with technology in particular. In fact, that's what Indiana has tried to kind of focus most of its attention on, is how to use technology in indigenous language preservation. They've partnered with local communities throughout the country, mostly out in the Northern Plains. I actually worked there for a while as well. But most of the partnering has either been with tribal colleges and K-12 elementary schools. They do, in fact, the Indiana does actually teach the Lakota language, and it's under the anthropology department. But what's interesting in terms of both Arizona, Kansas, and Indiana, there's a real effort in trying to get teacher training, trying to get people and community members in to learn kind of how to develop language programs. But at the same time, they haven't necessarily been teaching languages themselves. Oklahoma is a notable exception, and I wanted to just talk about that a little bit before I get to Ojibwe. The University of Oklahoma, in addition to its political prominence with being associated with NALI, has had a very effective language program. The Native Language Program has been around since 1991, not surprising because it coincides with the passage of the Native American Languages Act. And they actually, right now, teach four different languages. They offer Kiowa, Creek, Cherokee, and Choctaw at the University of Oklahoma. Of course, these are all communities that are in Oklahoma and close to Norman as well. They actually offer multiple years of all of these languages, including other things such as literature. Kiowa literature in particular is one that's offered. All of the classes are taught by native speakers, so people who speak it as their first language. But it's also kind of an important note that at University of Oklahoma, all of the speakers also have training in linguistics and have gone through a variety of training programs. The languages that are offered there satisfy both the College of Arts and Sciences and the university's language proficiency requirements. So it's a very well-developed program. Another important thing from the University of Oklahoma is that it is also focused on local curriculum design. And what they do is they kind of establish this arena or space for people, for native speakers and linguists and language teachers to come together and actually design curriculum as well. So it's a multi-focused project at the University of Oklahoma. They have a lot of things going on. And it really, as I think, it, in some ways it's become the epicenter of the movement of bringing indigenous languages into the university system as actually subjects of study. But it is important, and this is, we'll get to Michigan State, but at Oklahoma, it is also still taught under the anthropology department. All indigenous languages are under the anthropology department there as well. So let's move to large research universities with Ojibwe language programs. And I want to talk just primarily University of Minnesota, University of Michigan, and of course Michigan State University all offer Ojibwe language classes. I'm only going to talk about University of Minnesota and Michigan State today. Probably reasons for that, but that's not, no need to get into it. So we're going to talk about Michigan State. But first, I want to talk briefly about the University of Minnesota. There's a lot of things that are kind of important or distinguish University of Minnesota as a whole. It's known for having the oldest American Indian Studies program in the United States, so in the nation. It began in 1969, and there might be a few, I think there might be some who are older, but the critical thing about University of Minnesota is that the American Indian Studies program is actually a department. It has a departmental status. So it is the oldest program in the United States with a departmental status. One of the things, of course, the University of Minnesota, being in Minneapolis, being in the Twin Cities area, within a very large urban population, they have a lot of focus with outreach, with local urban communities, and then also the surrounding, both Ojibwe and Dakota communities, to the Twin Cities. The faculty themselves are from a wide range of disciplines, and then many of them are formally trained, but it's important too, they have a lot of academic specialists, and the faculty and the course offerings are supplemented with community resource people, including but not limited to speakers of indigenous languages, elders, artists, writers, musicians. So it's a very vibrant sort of program that they have there. The languages themselves at University of Minnesota have been taught, they were taught off and on, for quite a while, but really the established program for the last 10 years. And they teach both two languages. They teach both Ojibwe and Dakota. For both languages, they have a two-year sequence. There is a third-year Ojibwe class, and it focuses both on literature and grammatical structure. And they're in the process right now of starting a third-year Dakota project as well. They have a lot of, James Vukelich and Neil McKay are the Ojibwe and Dakota teachers, respectively. So it's been going on for quite a while. The Ojibwe teacher actually there is Dennis Jones, but he's on sabbatical this year. He's working on some curriculum project. So James Vukelich is actually taking his place. But this year they recognized the fact that that they really needed one of the ideas, because Minnesota has always focused a lot on outreach and outreach communities. That they wanted to be able to offer the classes so non-traditional students and community members could take them. So this past year, for the first time, they've been offering them in the evening. However, and it's kind of interesting, this has been met with limited success. The idea was right, that it would attract more community members and non-traditional students. However, University of Minnesota has realized that they have problems with both costs and competition. Of course, taking a class at University of Minnesota can be quite costly, and if you're a community member and you're not a full-time student, you're not eligible for financial aid, so you have to pay out of pocket. And one of the things that distinguishes Minnesota or the Minneapolis Twin Cities area is that there is actually competition. There's multiple Ojibwe programs. Augsburg College offers one, a few other. There's some local community centers that also offer Ojibwe. And so that's actually been a draw from the University of Minnesota program. But some of the other things that have been kind of critical about the Minnesota program, they have language societies, both the Dakota and Ojibwe language societies, and they have regular language tables. So people come together on a weekly basis and have dinner together and talk and learn together. Well, Michigan State, and in fact, again, there's people here who can talk a little bit even more officially about the beginnings of the program here at Michigan State. Officially, the American Indian Studies program began here in 2000. There have been plans, of course, for it prior to that, but it really became a program in 2000 with both the appointment of a director and also the establishment of a budget. And although that there were many faculty involved in teaching courses dedicated to American Indian Studies before that time, 2000 is really kind of the year that the American Indian Studies program started here. Of course, the Native American Institute had been started in the early 1980s by Dr. George Cornell, with a specific focus also on outreach to Michigan Native communities. So that outreach idea is similar between both Minnesota and Michigan State. And that's actually one reason, if we kind of even look why to even eliminate University of Michigan from this discussion, is that both University of Minnesota is also the land-grant university within Minnesota as well, as in a sense Michigan State is also the land-grant. There's a lot of ties between both the spirit and the spirit of both the American Indian Studies program there and the American Indian Studies program here. And it was recognized from the outset that language needed to be a part of the American Indian Studies program here, that it needed to be fully represented. And Mrs. Helen Roy began teaching in the fall of 2000 here at Michigan State, although she had come with much experience from other programs as well, including Central Michigan, Saginaw Chippewa Tribal College, and also Western Michigan, and years of work with Montessori kids as well. So, but she started teaching a two-year language sequence in the fall of 2000 and teaches currently language and linguistics 151, 152, 251, and 252, so a two-year sequence. Now, unlike Minnesota and unlike Indiana, the program here, the language program here, is placed in language and linguistics. And this is critical. It was a decision that was made because it recognizes, it fully recognizes the equal status of Ojibwe with any other language that's taught within the university system. It also then also fully requires any program's language requirements. They can take Ojibwe to satisfy that. So that's just kind of a brief history of it. Now I want to get into some of kind of the issues surrounding the teaching of indigenous languages. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about some real positive things that have come out of this transformation in the last 30 years. First of all, a lot of the universities, because of the language projects in particular, have found a way of partnering with local communities in a more substantive sort of way. And this, I think that this applies to all of the universities that I've talked about even heretofore. Also, it's focused on training speakers to become effective teachers. So it's really given people kind of the skills that they need to step into a language classroom. The status of indigenous languages, I think, because of this movement into the universities, have been increased. People have recognized them for both the fact that they're incredibly complex, very beautiful, and absolutely need to be and need to be both learned and passed on. There's also been the development of new materials, both reference and pedagogical. So those are some very positive things that have come out of these programs so far. But there's continuing issues. These language programs are generally successful. People are very happy with what they've been able to achieve with relatively little funding, with small amounts of people doing a huge amount of work. They've been very successful. But there are definitely some continuing issues. Throughout all of the programs, there are particular issues that have come up, such as the need for immersive environments, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Also, increasing the classroom opportunities and student enrollment seems to be a general issue that all of these language programs are faced with. And then also teacher training. Now, in my previous slide, I said that that's one of the successes, and there has been a lot of effort through a lot of these programs on teaching speakers how to become very effective teachers. But we're now getting into another phase where we're going to be looking at largely non-speakers who are going to be learning the language with the idea that then they can also go out and teach. And so that's a critical point and a critical juncture that a lot of these programs are at right now. Now I want to talk a little bit about creating an immersive environment. As probably is too well known, most indigenous languages in the United States and Canada right now are considered endangered. That means that the languages are not, there's been an interruption, they're not being transmitted to the younger generations, and there are fewer and fewer speakers as every generation passes. Now, in order, currently, and I have to admit that I'm someone who distrusts enumeration greatly. I don't like numbers. But in particular, in regard to Ojibwe, it's estimated that there's approximately 35,000 to 50,000 speakers of the various forms of Ojibwe and Odawa currently. That's not many. That is a fairly robust number in terms of indigenous languages, but it still is not many. And there's a definite fear of greater diminishment. This is especially critical in Michigan. Not many people who use the language in their daily lives. And as Helen has told me, that those who do, those who have both family and ability to use it, they're considered rich. It's something they're considered very rich and wealthy because they have a resource that many people don't. Now, one of the issues as the language continues to be diminished is, of course, there are fewer and fewer opportunities to use the language. People aren't doing the same things as people did before. And as you don't do these same sorts of activities, the language suffers. What we can think about it in terms of just the opportunities to use or the arenas of use are dwindling. And that's a problem, especially when we're talking about language learning. All of the language acquisition material, all of the literature out there on learning a second language always stress the issues of immersion. There is no better way, it's absolutely been established, of learning a language than through immersion. That is what people have to do. Any language program knows that is what its key to success is. In terms of indigenous languages, the critical thing, of course, is there are fewer immersive environments in which people can actually go and learn. In fact, so, you know, there's always the example, you know, you can always go to France if you want. You can study France for a number of years, but there's nothing like going to France to actually learning it. Well, when you're talking about Ojibwe, here is where you can learn it. This is it. This is the location. This is the place. And so since there is a continued diminishing of speaking communities, there has to be much more focus on an opportunity to create these immersive environments. Actually have to be created. We have to create ones here, and here truly meaning at Michigan State, where students are required to both speak and think in Ojibwe only. In addition to this is the issue of classroom materials. Just as there has to be a creation of immersive environments, there has to be a focus on materials development. There are just not the resources. Again, you can pick up any other sort of language book, you know, a literature that happens to be written in another language. Those same resources are not necessarily available for Ojibwe. When I'm talking about resources, too, I don't want to think in very limited ways as grammars and dictionaries, but really materials, any sort of material that can be used for language learning. All of the language teachers have to develop these themselves. There is no place to go to. It all has to come from themselves. And this often falls on the shoulders of the language teachers. They have to develop multiple classroom materials for language learning. They have to adapt anything that's out there. And in fact, again, Helen has told me she does, and she does. She uses everything that's out there. I mean, whether it be a menu from Damon's or something of that sort. But teachers have to be extremely resourceful because we live in an English-dominated community, and so it's a matter of taking all of those materials and translating them and actually being able to use them for Ojibwe. So this is, I think, one of the most critical issues in terms of indigenous languages right now in the universities. How can universities help to create these immersive environments? Secondly, I wanted to talk just briefly about classroom opportunities and student enrollment. Student enrollment is something that affects all indigenous language programs. Convincing students, why do you need to take these courses? One of the things that both in discussions here and discussions in Minnesota came up time and time again is the reasons why you need to learn the language. A person needs to learn Ojibwe for their own development, for their own well-being, for their own kind of sense of self, and again, sense of place, of where they exist in the world. It has to be for your own both benefit and understanding. There is not necessarily going to be a job waiting for you if you spend the years that are required in order to learn Ojibwe, but there are more important reasons for learning. One of the phrases that Helen Royce told me is that what the classes really are about, yes, they are language classes, yes, you do learn the language, but the classes teach you how to think, not just the language. It's a way of both seeing things, of doing things, of hearing things, and understanding things. So the value of the languages is far deeper than, in a sense, kind of a practical application or practical purpose. That you have to do that it really is kind of part of a more of a personal and an individual development. The other reasons for kind of encouraging students to come in and ways of kind of bringing them into the classes as well is to understand that there are certain things about Ojibwe culture that you can learn without the language, but it's only going to give you a partial glimpse. It's not going to give you everything that you have to, and again, as Helen was telling me, you have to know the language or else you just know the outer shell. You don't know what's really at the heart of it unless you know the language. In Minnesota, these same sentiments were expressed time and time again, that it's you can't tell students to come into these classes because it's going to have some sort of a practical application, but it has to come from a deeper place, that there has to be kind of a deeper reason why people want to take the classes. A lot of the students there expressed to me that once they got into the classes, they took it out of interest. They took the Ojibwe classes out of interest, but once they got in, they felt a real strong desire to really become involved in the language and a pull to become more involved in more substantive sorts of ways. One student in particular said that she didn't plan on taking the road kind of both to language learning and teaching, but when she got into that classroom, she felt like she couldn't leave, that's where she needed to be. One of the and again, time and time again, people express this idea that really it comes from a deeper place than just a practical purpose. But one of the comments from some of the students at Minnesota also said is that they found that there were opportunities for them after taking the classes, either teaching or with helping specifically with the development of language materials. So they said, you know, even if you go in, you can't go in thinking there's going to be something on the other side, but oftentimes opportunities do present themselves. And then finally, kind of just a last discussion on the ideas of why to take. I've already mentioned this, that both Michigan State and University of Minnesota are land-grant universities. And as Neil McKay, who is the Dakota teacher at Minnesota, told me, is that that truly, because we are land-grant institutions, there needs to be some substance to the idea that you need to learn the language of the land that you're on. And if you're on the land in Minnesota, the language of that land is both Dakota and Anishinaabemowin. If you're here in Michigan, the language is Anishinaabemowin. And so this appeals to both Ojibwe and non-Ojibwe students. Everyone should learn the language of the land that they're on. Now, one of the most, just in interest of time, move through this a little bit quicker. One of the issues, though, too, in terms of language study, we have to have, and I realize that I'm gone on quite a long time, so I'll try and move through this fairly quickly. But one of the other issues that all of these language programs have noticed is that we have to continue to create opportunities for language study, and there needs to be more classes. Helen has time and time again told me about this idea about how do you approach kind of language learning and with students. And it's like raising children, that kids are being fed, that you give them, just as you would give a baby, you know, you give them the language, and you have to give them a lot at first, and then as soon as, and they begin to learn, they begin to develop, and then they begin to kind of feed themselves. And it's a great analogy, because that's in fact what does happen with language. At first, there's very little talking on the part of the students, but a lot of emphasis from the teacher. But after a while, then students start to pick up on it. And they can then, in a sense, nourish themselves. But the problem is, with two-year language programs, once the students are out of the classroom, they're still at a very beginning level. And oftentimes, and this has been expressed both here and at University of Minnesota, there's nowhere else to go. There needs to be the development of new venues, new arenas for people to go and to continue this language learning. They just get kind of a taste of it in these first few years, and they need to go somewhere else. So either they have to create their own opportunities, which in kind of the present environment there aren't many, or there have to be opportunities created for them. And the universities in some ways can be a major role in developing those opportunities as well. And then just before I move on to some of the language events that we've had here, I want to say something about teachers. All of the teachers that I've met, all of the teachers that I've talked to, teachers are an incredibly precious, a precious thing, and the demands and the commitments of especially Ojibwe language teachers is extremely high. All of the teachers that I talk to, they don't merely just go into the classroom, teach their class, and leave. They live the language in all aspects of their lives. It's not just a job, it's something that they do. A lot of, again, time and time again, people talk about, you know, being in the classroom is really only one aspect of it. All the language teachers that I talk to speak with their families in the language, continue to consult with other elders, are deeply involved in outreach activities. Every teacher has been involved in multiple outreach projects, development of materials. It's something that is a tremendous amount of commitment on their part. And it takes an incredible amount of patience among these teachers as well. In terms of teaching for indigenous languages, because this is such a demanding and takes such of a commitment, it's difficult to find people with this combination of both language skills, passion, and compassion that is necessary for the language classroom. And so also when we talk about teacher development, it's not merely going through a set amount of classes and then being certified to teach. Something else more profound has to go on, that teachers really have to understand that it is a lifelong commitment to both if they're not speakers, to both learning the language and then also to teaching the language as well. Now, I want to move, just in kind of our last few minutes that I have here, talking about some of the things that have happened here at Michigan State to try and address some of these problems that have that face kind of bringing indigenous languages into the university structure. And one of the things that we've really focused on here, and in particular, Helen and I have worked very hard on creating what would be considered immersive environments. And basically, we've had three different types of opportunities. And what all of these, what links all of these together is both the focus on using Ojibwe and using Ojibwe only, or using as much Ojibwe as possible and least amount as English as possible. And then it's also a way of bringing in multiple generations of people, that it's not just students, but we bring in community members, kids, so on and so forth. So all of these things are ways of kind of creating, again, that space that's required for language programs to be successful. The immersion feasts are modeled after the successful language tables at University of Minnesota. At Minnesota, they have potlucks that are organized by student groups and student organizations, and they're funded, actually, because since they're a student organization, they have access to university funds, but the students also do their own fundraising. They make calendars, they do buttons, so on and so on and so forth. At Michigan State, what we've done for the immersion feasts is that we've come together, and we've usually come together at Nokomis, and we focused on doing things together. And a number of the first times that we came together, it was really a focus on making food and creating a meal and eating together. So both preparing food and eating together was the focus of them. And again, this was all done in Anishinaabe Mwin as much as possible. Sometimes Little English kind of came in there as well, but it was as much of a focus on Anishinaabe Mwin as possible. Now, because of health issues, we had to stop cooking. We were in violation of lots of health standards. So, last immersion feast, we actually, minor point, but the last immersion feast we actually had wasn't a feast, but we did have food there. There was a focus on beading, and Elizabeth Kimowan came in and did a beading demonstration. And it was, it was a wonderful thing, and beading in particular was a terribly effective thing when you're talking about language learning, because we were talking about numbers, counting, colors, everything that was reinforced through that activity of beading. Again, the immersion feast, there's been a focus on having multiple generations there. In the past, we've had a number of speakers come together. And that's been great because it's given those of us who've had the opportunity to be there, you can hear the language, you can hear it being used in a real kind of free environment, in a very kind of, you get to hear people joke and talk and just to have Ojibwe all around. Now the Quiz Bowl, I shouldn't have to speak much of because I think there were a lot of participants who were here. We had the third annual Ojibwe Quiz Bowl just on Saturday night, and Helen really developed these. They're modeled after the quiz bowls that you can see on public television that local schools do. The critical features of the Quiz Bowl, it's a little bit more structured than the immersion feast. It's not kind of as loose and free-flowing, but again, they're conducted almost exclusively in Ojibwe. There is no English translation. Students are quizzed in Ojibwe, the answers are all in Ojibwe. Now, it's changed a little bit in the past few years, and I won't go into that much. But what the Quiz Bowl really does is it gives, for anybody who comes and watches it, it illustrates what goes on in terms of the classroom as well. It's really kind of a window into the classroom and the classroom learning, and what Helen does in terms of trying to really encourage people to use the language and use kind of props and other sorts of things to get away from English and to only use Anishinaabe Mwin. The Quiz Bowl itself showcases a tremendous amount of student knowledge. But it also invites audience participation through intermission activities. And anybody, again, who has been at the Quiz Bowl probably has bags and t-shirts to prove the fact that we have this this audience participation. But it's fun. It's an incredibly fun event, but there's more that's going on as well. It shows kind of the ties that the language has to be tied to community in order for it to also kind of both succeed and to survive. It's a way of bringing college students in touch with community members. Our judges are all speakers, and invited to come and to participate in this event as well. For the last few, both the Immersion Feast, the Quiz Bowl, and the Dance Showcase, I've been doing surveys. And a lot of the responses in the surveys is that most of the people who attend come from both word of mouth and from announcements in classes. And what all of them talk about in terms of being what are the things that they like the best about these is the fact that it does bring so many different people together. And then the last one I wanted to talk about was the Dance Showcase. This was the we had our first dance showcase last fall in October 25th. And what it was also, very similar to the other, to the Immersion Feast and the Quiz Bowl, the Dance Showcase was essentially a way of learning language and really kind of demonstrating the breadth and the beauty of Anishinaabe Mohin, and it gave an opportunity for people who knew a little bit of the language to increase their language learning as well. Essentially what the Dance Showcase was one session of a powwow. We invited two drums, a head male and female dancers who were both MSU students, which is, I think, a critical point, and we also had an invited head veteran. And it was an entire full session. We began with a grand entry. We had an exhibition of various dance styles, intertribals, two-step round dance, honor songs, and it all ended up with a giveaway as well. The entire dance showcase was announced in Anishinaabe Mohin with only brief English discussion, and I'll come to that in a second. But it was really important because it was language and context, that you weren't just hearing the language and it wasn't just kind of a language lesson, but in fact you were learning something about the community, about the culture as well, especially through dance. And many people, both at the event and then later on, have commented about how extraordinary it was to hear the language and to participate in the dancing. And Helen emceed the event all in Anishinaabe Mohin, so the whole thing was in Anishinaabe Mohin. And people also commented how wonderful it was to see the children. We had a lot of children who came and danced, and how great it was to see older people and younger people coming together and using the language. Now, one of the things that's, as kind of conclusions or some thoughts, one of the things that permeates a lot of the talk about indigenous languages right now is the use of technology. And technology is a wonderful sort of aspect. There's been a lot of work on digital audio recording, creation of multimedia lessons, so on and so forth. But I think that there really needs to be kind of a more of a focus on how do we use technology to create these immersive environments. Now, Helen in particular has been very effective in using technology. For all of these events that I talked about, she's created PowerPoint presentations. In fact, somebody coined the phrase the PowerPoint powwow for the dance showcase last fall, that it was the first PowerPoint powwow that they had been. We also use the PowerPoint in the Quiz Bowl. But it's really important, and this is I want to use this as a very important example of responsible uses of technology in Indigenous language programs, because what these did was allowed us to have an immersive environment, because the PowerPoint presentations had both Anishinaabe Mohin and then English. For the people who didn't know Anishinaabe Mohin, they still felt like they could participate because they had the English translation. But the important thing is that it allowed then Helen not to compromise. She could still only use the language, and you didn't have to look if you really wanted to test yourself. And I think that that's a critical thing in terms of language learning. There has been a lot of focus on technology. There's been a lot of grant money that have been given to creating, again, multimedia lessons. And that is good, but sometimes that's been too much of the focus. And what we really need to be thinking about is how do we use technology in the environments like we've used here at Michigan State, where the focus and always the target is to get people to use Ojibwe, to use Ojibwe as much as possible. So how do we use these great tools as a way of encouraging what is the ultimate goal? And another sort of, so just to really kind of encourage people to kind of think more about this and how to use technology in a responsible sort of way. The second thing that in terms of kind of a conclusion or what remains to be done, I left it off and didn't necessarily talk fully about these upper level courses. But one of the things, and this is tied into technology as well, there needs to be more institutional cooperation in both materials development and higher level language courses. Again, technology has a role to play in this, distance learning and so on and so forth. There are opportunities to create web-based classrooms and then also kind of virtual classrooms where we can get students here at Michigan State and students at University of Minnesota to try and take classes at higher levels. So they might go through the two-year language program here, the two-year language program there. But as I said, one of the problems is they have no place else to go after that. Well, we're trying to now develop ideas. I mean, that's actually one thing that might be coming out of this project in particular, are real substantive discussions with the University of Minnesota to use the CIC, the Consortium for Institutional Cooperation, to develop a third-year Ojibwe course that gives students both here and there an opportunity to pursue language training even more. And we need to focus a lot more on this, on creating partnerships. And it should extend beyond just Minnesota, University of Minnesota and Michigan State, and does need to incorporate the tribal colleges in the communities. That's where you can't have language without their support and their help. And then finally, just to recognize that the thing that comes up time and time again is that language has to be a priority. Everybody is very busy. Everybody has many excuses as to why they don't do things. But it's not a question of people being busy, but it's a question of people making choices. And in order for indigenous languages to be successful, in order for them to be successful within the university structure, both individuals as well as institutions need to continue to make language a priority. So I'm going to conclude there. I'm sorry I went over the time that I felt like I should have, and I wanted to give an opportunity if anybody has any questions. I know we're over time, but if anybody has any questions, please feel free to ask. I have much more if you want to if you want to engage in some conversation. Yes.
On the last point, the question I had in terms of the coordination across
Yes, it is and it isn't. There are of course a number of different dialects for Ojibwe, and Odawa is also closely related, and people will talk about dialectal differences, but these can be overcome. So especially the idea of people can learn kind of what's being taught locally, and then a third year program would really focus on kind of more structure and translation and correspondence between dialects. As Helen told me, it is all one language. It really is. And yes, there on the surface it might seem quite different, but once you've become fairly proficient in one, then you're able to do the correspondences. And I actually, in a conversation with John Nichols, who's the linguist over at Minnesota, he's concerned greatly with issues of dialect. But we talked about really creating a class that you almost take the dialects as the central point and try and work on correspondences between kind of the Michigan and Minnesota and Canadian dialects as well. So it's an issue that comes up that, yes, our idea is that we can take it on and perhaps work through it. There's also issues, of course, that's a whole other issue, writing, literacy, and orthographic standardization. But that's actually becoming more, people are becoming much more, especially within Anishinaabe, Mohin, there's been a number of conferences where people have come together and talked about the establishment of writing systems, and they're really moving towards some consensus there. I mean, there still is variation, but there's a lot more consensus out there in building.
Talking about the writing systems, that makes me curious about whether or not there are any books that support that immersion.
Yes, and that's going to be... They're becoming more and more available through the work of some very dedicated people. First of all, again, back to the language teachers. I cannot emphasize how hard the language teachers work. They have done a lot on their own in terms of translating just even children's books. And they'll do children's books even for adult classrooms because they're just such an effective way. And so a lot of people have taken that on the teachers have done that on their own. But there is much more of a movement, and actually Tony Truer is probably... who's at Bemidji State, has been one of the most effective in actually creating kind of a literature base of Ojibwe as well. His book, Living Our Language, is a bilingual collection of stories. And Louise Erdrich has moved into that direction as well. And of course, she owns Birch Bark Books in Minneapolis. And she's actually started publishing Nawagisis, is also a new collection out that's a bilingual reader. So people have recognized that, in fact, talking about the immersive environment, reference grammars, and there are some good ones. Rand Valentine has a great reference grammar for Ojibwe. But dictionaries and grammars are not what you need for creating a language program. You need something to read, and there's been a recognition and a movement towards that and towards the incorporation of literature. I don't know. I don't doubt that someone's done a cookbook. I know there's probably is. Oh, we should have done a cookbook. We'll do it. We should do one. We should do a cookbook. yeah, we made some really good food though. But yeah, that's a great idea. I'm sure there is one out there. And again, a lot of this has been locally produced. And one of the things where I think universities really have a role is to bring all this information and resources together and really help kind of with the coordination and collaboration. So,
weeks ago, I was at the University of Oklahoma, and I was at the new museum, the Sam Noble Museum of Natural History, and they now have, and you know the person probably.
Mary Lynn. Yeah.
That's what they've done, because essentially they've created, she's almost the curator of the native language programs for the state.
Yeah.
And they've done it in the museum context, and she carries on that original role that you described, mm-hmm. in the anthropology departments that were involved in documentation and the records and collections, but now doing outreach and programming and bringing together native language teachers, a remarkable program.
Yes.
A lot of federal support, interesting enough.
Mm-hmm.
But is that just so unusual, or are you starting to see those connections with that go back to the earlier point that you made about building collections and now living program?
No, I think it's a model that people are, I think it is exceptional in some cases, but I think that is the model that people are moving more and more towards. What's that? We should do it here, or there should be some sort of a movement towards that. And that's actually really critical, because Mary Lynn in particular, her position is curator of languages, and she teaches one class, but 50% of her time is purely for the development of language programs. This takes a lot of work. It takes an incredible amount of coordination. And of course, within the university system, I didn't talk about it, you have the focus on kind of the traditional tenure and what's recognized. And that's been one of the big issues why universities haven't gone that way. And Oklahoma, I think, is doing something bold and saying that her job and what she actually should do to be successful is to really spend most of her time in outreach.
The museum context seems to be working very well.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It's a beautiful facility if no one's been there. Sam Noble Museum is a beautiful, beautiful facility. Yeah, Jim.
You mentioned that the numbers are somewhere between 25 and 35,000 Ojibwe.
35 to 50.
35 to 50? Okay.
Depending on who you read.
Two sub-questions, one of clarification, one of quantification. One, when you say speakers, do you mean who have some ability to speak the language? Or people who use the language on a regular basis.
See, that's why I don't like numbers.
That's
yeah. And that's why I don't like numbers. And in fact, actually, there's been a lot of work on this, because one of the things in terms of anybody who's written grants for language programs, you have to do numbers of speakers. And it's so hard to say because of those reasons precisely. So that's why even, depending on who you read, 35 to 50,000, and that's not specific in terms of people who would consider themselves, because you can divvy it up, people who spoke Anishinaabemowin as their first language, learned English later, people who are truly bilingual or who were raised bilingually, and then people, of course, who came to Ojibwe later in life and learned it in a schooled context or a learning sort of context. And then, of course, there's semi-speakers and so on and so forth. And so those numbers they're not more specific than that.
Right.
So, and they're used in different sorts of ways. So I doubt them. But you had a second question?
The demographic part of the question is, over how many states or provinces, the states and provinces, do those people spread?
The number of 35,000 I have seen in application to Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, which seems high. But and then 50,000 including all of the, that's a larger, that includes the province, Canadian provinces as well. Well, I've seen the number of 50,000, and those two aren't connected. I've read the number 35,000 referencing the United States. I've seen the number 50,000 referencing the Great Lakes region. So that's not to think that there's, because I agree with you, there's far more than 20,000, yeah. So the question is, were some of those 35 that were counted in the U.S., were they actually Canadian as well.
Probably Canadian.
Yeah.
Because that Great Lakes, you know, before the border, it's all the central Great Lakes area, including Canada.
Yeah, yeah. So there's, and so I don't doubt that at all. So, and that's actually, and that's one of the things, this arbitrary border that separates Canada and the United States. It's a problem in the universities. We've run into it here, and Minnesota ran into the same thing. When you want to bring speakers, even if they've got to, they have to be U.S. citizens, or else the tax codes and so forth. There's a lot of bureaucratic structures that kind of rear their ugly heads. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but Minnesota. I was talking to some people in Minnesota. They had the same sort of problems. But anyway, that's one of the issues I didn't really bring up. There's lots more I could say, but there are kind of institutional structures that still go against really kind of creating effective language programs, because there's so many rules and regulations that we have to adhere to within the university that sometimes are opposite to what we know would make a very good either event or, like, the food, for example. You know, we don't want to make anybody sick, but we'd also like to have the opportunity to cook together. You know, that seems like a very basic sort of idea, but when you get the university involved, it brings in a whole host of other problems. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, and these are problems that they face us here, and they face Minnesota as well. And I think that there is an opportunity, though, to maybe kind of work together and maybe include it even broader than even a region. Oh, that was the other, one of my points. There have been really effective regional programs, but I think that there needs to be more cooperation in the Great Lakes, because there isn't necessarily a Great Lakes focus. Oklahoma has a tremendous one. The Southwest, there's a tremendous one. But there's lots of speakers here, and there should be. The Great Lakes needs to be more of a focus for language study as well. So, any other questions? I do apologize for going over there. Self-editing. Thank you.